My earliest church memory is gazing upward at Pastor Carl Pshaw in his long linen robe and his big brown beard as he played guitar for the congregation, and the children sat before him, and we all sang, "This is the day that the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." It was 1985. I was 5 years old. In a small white country church in rural Minnesota, and don't you know, most of the folks in our town were Lutheran. You betcha. And Norwegian. Every Sunday was, "I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord." It was singing hymns like, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God," and "It is well with my soul." Once a month, we ate Jesus and drank his blood. And communion was weird to me as a kid. Still is. And then there would be Sunday school where I had to memorize commandments and psalms and learn about prophets. And I remember thinking that John the Baptist was the coolest because he lived outside and wore camel skins and ate bugs and honey and dunked people in the river. I even attended Luther Crest Bible Camp some summers, where we gathered in a big cabin with our cool camp counselors and sang really groovy songs like "Hip Holy Jesus" with some cool dance moves. So imagine, if you will, 100 white Lutheran 12-year-olds channeling Elvis or Chubby Checker singing, "Jesus, Jesus, hip holy Jesus, you're the one that we adore. Guide us, Jesus, won't you guide us down the path you laid before." I never thought I would do that in public. So, obviously we were super hip. And, or as some of my friends called us, on fire for Jesus. That's what we were supposed to be. It was on fire for Jesus. But I never really felt on fire for anything. I remember the routine and the expectations of church, but I never recall feeling a lot of purpose or meaning. Our spiritual time as a congregation occurred on Sunday mornings and only within the walls of that church, and there wasn't action outside of it. No one ever discussed with me why we believed what we did, why we were Lutheran, or talked about any other kind of faith group or spirituality. And it certainly didn't occur to me that I could question what we believed. My family wasn't good at talking about stuff, certainly not faith or spirituality or really anything outside chores and the farm and school. So I grew up in this safe, sheltered bubble where everything was familiar and everyone knew everyone and my world was this big. And nothing bad had ever happened to me or anyone I loved. And of course, life doesn't remain that simple or safe. And eventually we all learn about the inevitability of loss. In 1994, when I was 14, my grandpa, to whom I was very close, was assaulted and murdered in Minneapolis during an attempted robbery. I was only 14, and the world made sense 1 minute, and then the next felt unreal. And facing that brutality and suffering that the world could send our way was just more than I knew how to hold. The day of his memorial, the pastor told us that God has a plan and everything happens for a reason. And for the first time, I felt something in church. Anger. Profound anger. Because I couldn't accept what had happened as part of some grand plan. And I thought of that framed picture in our house that every house that I knew of had hanging in it about the footprints of God and how when we were in struggle, God carried us across the sand. And I didn't feel carried by anything. So I decided in that moment that I would refuse everything I'd ever been taught about religion, that it was a lie and a waste of time. Because I was a teenager and like totally knew everything, except how to recognize and shepherd myself through that kind of grief and all the emptiness that can accompany it. So I refused church, didn't attend service, never went to another church camp, gave up on the idea of anyone looking out for me, and to be truthful, judged those who did believe that kind of harshly. Because again, I was a teenager and like totally knew everything. My mom tried to lure me back to church eventually, resorting sometimes to threats. If you don't come with me, you're going to have to go with your dad to haul wood every Sunday. So I thought about that for a minute because it was January in Minnesota and maybe 10 above zero. And still said, you betcha, Mom, I'll go get my long johns on. She gave up after that, and I hauled a lot of wood. Years later, as a college sophomore, I enrolled in a nonfiction writing workshop to write memoir and personal essay. And our first assignment was, write about a moment you knew you weren't a kid anymore. And I knew that moment. Reflecting now, having taught college students, I'd say that that's a hard first assignment. And you might want to start with something gentler. But for the first time in my life, I wrote about it. About my grandpa and how close we were. About planting grass seed in the pasture with him and riding the tractor and carrying oats to the horses in the evenings. And how he came to me in a dream one night, 5 years after he died, and we rode a tandem bicycle in the mountains. And how I knew I wasn't a kid anymore the moment I decided God wasn't real and that I felt I no longer belonged in any church. After reading my essay, one of my classmates said, you should check out Unitarian Universalism. To which I replied, you know what now? I had no idea what he was talking about, but since he was a handsome Air Force medic, I said, tell me more. Tell me more. As we became friends that semester, he told me about growing up in Jefferson Unitarian Church in Denver. And it's Church Across the Street program, where he visited a Catholic church and a Buddhist temple and a mosque and a synagogue. And I said, were you allowed to do that? Like, did you need a special pass? And then he told me about their Our Whole Lives lifespan sexuality education. You can't talk about that stuff in church. But mostly he spoke about the community he found there. A unique, diverse group of people who didn't all believe the same stuff, but showed up for each other just the same. And he talked about some mentors he found there who remained in his life and became his surrogate parents to whom he was still close. None of that fit with what I knew to be church. So I went to a UU service in Colorado Springs. Felt real weird walking in the door. Didn't talk to anyone. When people passed the microphone around and started talking about their joys and their concerns, I felt uncomfortable because in my church, the pastor spoke and we listened, and there was not a big focus on the sharing of feelings. Lutheran Norwegians aren't great at that. And yet at the end of the service when I left, as uncomfortable as I'd felt, it was my favorite part. It still is. I didn't become a UU then, but I did at least begin pondering what spirituality meant. Something perhaps more nuanced than the rules and the creeds of my youth. During my college years, I had a mentor who returned to school at age 67 to study theology and become a chaplain after a long career of being a teacher, a principal, and a professor. And she told me and tells me still, oh, honey, God is just all that is. That's just another way of saying connection to all, and it is sacred and beloved, and it's a feeling, not a set of rules. So I gave that a try, turned my attention toward where I might find this connection to all with a capital A. I stood overlooking Long Bay in Alaska and felt something, just as I did when I climbed Colorado Mountains or hiked up Kitchen Mesa at Ghost Ranch in New Mexico and looked out at Mount Pedernal. I found connection to all on a hiking trail. Around that time, I attended another UU service with friends in Reno and witnessed my first water ceremony, and I felt connection to all that day. The other place I sought meaning during this time was in books, and I amassed my own collection of sacred texts. I pondered the words of Parker Palmer, a Quaker elder, read some Stoic philosophers, the poems of Wendell Berry and Mary Oliver. I read beautiful novels that were explorations of real faith, like Peace Like a River by Leif Anger and I Know This Much Is True by Wally Lamb. I found humor and comfort in Anne Lamott's essays and inspiration in the words of Terry Tempest Williams. And I was brought to tears by the words of Father Greg Boyle, a Jesuit priest who has spent his career ministering to gang members in Los Angeles. But it was the author Barbara Kingsolver who wrote in one of her early nonfiction essays something that I hang on to still. In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing. A flame of red geranium outside my window. My daughter in a yellow dress. Until I learned to be in love with my life again. Like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills. I have taught myself joy over and over again. So I chant these private vows. Wherever I am, let me never forget to distinguish want from need. Let me be a good animal today. It took all that time, all those years of dipping my toe in, visiting UU services, reading that smorgasbord of writers and thinkers, to consider that maybe spirituality and grace weren't off the table for me just because I didn't believe what I'd been taught as a kid. That I am not broken, and that our uncertainty and questions do not make us unworthy of acceptance. My husband and I came here on the day Reverend Katie had just joined the congregation. We visited again over the span of months that my baby kicked in my belly and I prayed for courage. We visited again the night after the 2016 election. I again prayed for courage. And in 2018, we signed the book. I still have questions, a big old list of them. And in the absence of certainty, I find it's best to just turn hard toward gratitude. How grateful I am for my parents, for my mom who insisted on church and tried her best to raise a good Lutheran, and my dad who showed me that being quiet outside in the woods is spirituality too. How grateful I am for the little girl inside me right now saying, "You can't say that stuff in church. You're breaking the rules." Because there's an almost 40-year-old Unitarian lady who can answer back, "Well, if hip holy Jesus is listening in, he's just going to have to go ahead and love me anyway. Because I'm just trying to be a good animal today." How grateful I am for that kid in a college class who suggested I visit the Unitarian Church. He knew I needed something even before I did. How grateful I am that after 17 years of knowing him and 11 of being his wife, it's still true. Also, he's the guy who told me I could say this stuff, so if you take issue with any of it, raise your hand, honey. Talk to that guy. Right there. Lifelong UU. How grateful I am for this church that teaches us we need not think alike to love alike. For those of you who've sat in these places longer than I have, that might not be news, but it was to me. Here I see people who model kindness and service and grace every day within these walls, but more importantly, outside of them. That is love in action. And that's the kind of church I want to show up for. The kind I never witnessed or was part of as a kid. A place in which we can all teach ourselves joy again and again. Thus, I'm just grateful for my small place in all that is here and now. For the journey and for the flesh and blood people who walk beside me across the sand. These things are well with my soul. And they're enough. Amen and blessed be.
So I was wondering, what did you do to lead up to being able to share your story? What did it take to kind of discover what you needed to get in touch with and what was important to say?
I think it has to do with being about to turn 40 and becoming more comfortable with doing stuff that like scares the crap out of me. And finding like worth in that feeling, I tell my college students all the time when they're beginning journalists and they're really afraid of like walking up to a stranger and asking them questions, there's worth in being a little scared and doing things that are uncomfortable, and like leaning into that discomfort can teach you stuff. And so, I mean, really, Reverend Katie and I were talking one day, and we needed a November person, and she nominated me, but I said yes and was open to it because I think it's good to do stuff that scares us. And, we're still new here and I don't know anybody. And she's like, well, this is a way for you to know people. I'm like, okay, that's really all. And I wanted to go through that like birthing process of writing something.
Okay, well, we'll get started with some reflections and thoughts and background and comments. And I kind of keyed into what Bobby was saying, is that people were asking me questions about you just personally. Are you teaching now?
Like, I don't know this
woman. Because we don't. So would you want to give us just a tiny little bio?
Oh, sure. Okay. So I have a master's degree in creative nonfiction writing. From the Northeast Ohio Consortial MFA program. It's a Master of Fine Arts degree, which is like a PhD for arty people. It's a terminal degree like a PhD, but you don't have to write a dissertation. You write a book, which I don't know what the difference is, but... So I was a journalist for a long time. That writing class that I took in college, actually, where my husband and I met... my mentor there was a journalist for the Colorado Springs Gazette for a long time, and so I started writing for them in college just as a freelance stringer. They paid me like $50 an article. I was like, woo! And then I graduated and worked for a little paper, a newspaper in Craig, Colorado, the Moffat County Morning News. It's not in existence anymore. And then I moved to the Colorado Springs Gazette, and I was an education reporter for a while, and then covered cops, crime, and breaking news at night. And that was interesting. And that got a little weary on my soul. Lots of bad news reporting. You know, the cops beat isn't particularly uplifting. So then I moved to D.C. to be with Jared and worked in public relations for a while, because lots of journalists make that jump from the writing side to the PR flack side. So I did that for a while. And then I went to grad school because I wanted to write a book like my mentor had, and because I got a fellowship so I didn't have to pay for it.
And she doesn't look near old enough to have done all of that, for sure. You've got one kid or two?
Just one.
Just one?
Yep, just one. Locke, he's five.
Okay, all righty. We'll start out here with Elizabeth.
I just wanted to know what the name of your book is.
It's called Home Fires, Essays on Roots, Restlessness, and Renewal. And it's in the closet, like literally in my closet. And no one's really read it or seen it other than like my family. But it's about, it's place writing. It's about searching for home and sense of place when you leave the one that you had grown up in, both physically and metaphorically. I left home when I was 17 and went to art school in Minneapolis, which was very difficult for my parents. They were very worried for me. So it's a collection of essays about all the places I've lived and why and searching for home when really, like, I don't think you ever... I have yet to feel the way I did about the farm where I grew up when I was a kid, you know, for good and ill. No. I can make you a photocopy.
So, Bobby, I think, about 15 minutes? Sermon message, is that what it was?
I tried to pack it into that.
Yeah, I thought it was about 15 minutes of poetry. It was just beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Probably do write poetry.
I don't write poetry.
No, you just speak it.
I just want to say that Vern and I did a writing workshop with Bobby about how do you get those ideas out and on paper. And we did it here over in Bowman Hall. It was fabulous, and we're encouraging her to give us another round. And I just encourage you all to come. You don't have to be a writer. It was so inspiring.
Thanks, Sharon. You guys did so great.
Well, actually, it's not just as much for me getting it out, but getting it here. That I express from here what I feel and put that in writing. So I really appreciate that, the workshop.
I just have to do this. Let's see. I went to Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington, and the cheer on the football field was, I forgot it all of a sudden.
Did it have something
but it
to
was,
do
it
with
it ended
Nepali
up with
Jesus?
Yashur, you betcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're for PLU, yeah, sure, you betcha.
Yeah, sounds like home.
So anyway, your story was similar in some ways because of that background and that coming out of a completely different mindset and theological basis after 4 years of required chapel at PLU when they stood at the end of the line and, you know, took attendance for everybody. And I graduated not only with a degree, but also with a new religion.
Now, when Bo and Bobby and I met to just kind of go over what she was going to be doing, she said, well, what do you think? What if I show a little dancing? Would that be a little weird? And I said, no, go for it.
Yeah, I almost cut that part out because it's deeply embarrassing. But
no,
we really did,
it was
like...
great. It was great because my background is in public speaking, and her talk definitely exemplified so many wonderful organizational styles. You know, start with a little humor, and, you know, people were laughing and then people were crying and, you know, really covered all the emotions.
That was my hope, was that everyone would cry. I really wanted you all to feel sad. Him and then.
It's interesting how some of those, you remembered all the words to that.
To Hip Holy Jesus?
Yeah.
How could you forget?
Well.
It was a very poignant time as a 12-year-old.
I mean, many of us came from other, you know, other traditions, and I still remember the one true Catholic and Apostolic Church.
Yep.
You know, and lots of other things from a Catholic upbringing. So other stuff really sticks with you. I got to give Bobby a little shout. I'd never heard of her until Shannon brought her in to tighten up the language writing on the Legacy Fund brochure
a
year
that.
Or two ago. Yeah, when we did that. So thanks for that.
Sure.
I have a comment. You're not the only person I've heard say, well, I met my wife or husband, right? When I went to graduate school, and actually before that, I had about 2 dates in 5 years. I mean, man, I worked all the time. I can't imagine meeting anybody that would talk to them. But nevertheless, you said you left home when you were 17 or something like that?
I did.
I would like you to elaborate on what you think is appropriate to elaborate on. For instance, did your family support you when you left home, or were you kind of outcast because you left the farm and didn't want to take over, and so you got a job and went to art school? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Could you, in 20 words or less?
I can't, and not in 20.
I'm just kidding. But could you elaborate just a little bit on that, please?
Yeah. I really wanted something new and different and couldn't wait to be gone from that little tiny bubble for many reasons. My parents were wonderful in their own ways and worked very hard. And I wanted an out. And so there was this, it's called the Perpich Center for Arts in Minneapolis, and it's an audition-only public high school of 300 kids, 150 juniors and 150 seniors. And I applied for my senior year in the music program and got in, and then it became kind of a mom battling dad and advocating on my behalf and dad not wanting me to go kind of thing, because I was 17 and they were not... We weren't city people. Like, I didn't fly on an airplane until I was 19. We stayed. I don't think I traveled outside our time zone until that point. Like, we stayed home. And I didn't give my mom enough credit at the time for advocating on my behalf, because it was really hard for her. But she knew that I needed something new and different, and I was never going to be. I was never going to be part of my family who all lived in a 20-mile radius. And, I should give her a buzz and say thank you for that. And then they just kind of let me go from there because they knew they had to, I think.
Thank you so much. That was awesome.
Thanks.
I also want to say that Bobby is a great editor. I can get the ideas out, but she really has refined some things for me around
circle
supper.
You do a great job.
You make it better.
Circle suppers are important.
And I wanted to ask if you had siblings.
I have a sister. She's 4 years older than me, and her name is Toni, not Antoinette. Everyone thinks that my parents wanted boys because I'm Bobby and she's Toni. And she lives at home or very close to my parents and does not go to church at all, and has an only son like I do. We are very different, but we went without speaking for like 3 years recently, and then she came and visited this summer with her son, my nephew, and we had a lovely time, and it was really good. So I feel thankful for what she is, and I don't expect her to be the things that I know she is not going to be.
So I wanted to ask you a couple questions. Did you say music?
Mm-hmm.
Are you a musician?
In private?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What instrument?
I play guitar and I sing.
Ah.
Yeah.
And
I know.
Oh boy, do we? We would love to have you. Yeah.
Can I sing? Like, I don't. I guess if I can
Holy
sing,
Jesus,
like,
or
Hip Holy Jesus.
Yeah.
Mostly, it's my, like, I don't have any range, and so I would sing with, like.
That's okay. Come.
What's below a tenor? That's what I am.
Good. Come. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come. So obviously you're a wordsmith. Where did you get your love of writing?
My high school English teacher, Mary Guthos. Yep, that's when I first started writing. And then that writing mentor I had in the writing class where I met Jared. And a number of people in my life who have talked about the value of storytelling and how we all have something worthwhile to say. And I told this story in the workshop, so I'm sorry. But when I was in grad school, I got a fellowship to travel to Bisbee, Arizona, this quirky little town, and study with Bob Wick, who's a sculptor who lives there. He founded the Wick Poetry Center at my university. And so he's a sculptor first and foremost and a writer after that. And we spent a week with him, and we're each working on, it was me and four other students working on our individual projects. And the night that we left, we all shared our work and talked about what we had been working on. And when we were all done, Bob looked at us and he said, "I want you to leave here knowing that each of you has unique art within you that only you can give to the world. Only you. No one else can do it." And No one had ever told me that before I was 32. I needed to hear that before that time, and I think it's so true of storytelling just the same. Like, no one can, like, no one could have said today what I said because it's unique to my experience, and only I can go through the birthing process that it is to shape a story. And that's true for everybody. That's true for each of you. Like, everybody has an important and poignant story to tell, and it doesn't need to be sensational. It doesn't need to be like a sweeping epic. It just needs to be real. And you just got to say it with as much like truth and honesty as you can muster. And then it will be good. You just got to get it there, which takes some time.
And then I just wanted to ask, did they ever catch the assailant?
Yeah, there were two. They arrested the accomplice. My grandparents owned a hotel in Minneapolis, and my grandpa was called in one night because the original overnight guy was sick, so he wasn't supposed to be there. His name was Wes, and he was 59. And they caught the accomplice guy who ratted out the gentleman who pulled the trigger, and they were both arrested and tried. And the man who shot him comes up for parole in like 2 years. So I don't know what I do about that. Or go to the parole board. I don't know. Yeah. That's a hard one.
Thanks. Thanks, Bobby. You just said everyone has a story to tell. And during the workshop, you showed us the bubble concept of different bubbles from different aspects, life stories, what come to us. So I really feel even more encouraged to write a story, because it's not just a story. It's when you put an art piece together out of different components.
Collage.
And that collage is who we are. How I feel I am, because there are different components, different stories, different moods, and they all make up me.
That's right.
So, thanks.
Most of the people here who've done a My Story have done so in our past format, which was 5 minutes, right? And so I was surprised when Katie said, oh, I have a volunteer, let's just do one. And I thought, huh.
Who's some this lady who has so much
that?
To say?
You know, some people have a 15-minute story. Other people may not have a 15-minute story. So I guess I'm kind of processing that. So any feedback, I know most of you have done 5 minutes, thought I can't do this in 5 minutes. That's way too short. If you haven't done a story other than the people who went to the workshop, would you be willing to speak 15 to 20 minutes?
If she helps me.
Okay.
She will.
Great answer.
She will.
Great answer.
I spend all my time, in my teaching capacity, I spend all my time with like 18-year-olds, right? And they all want to write about their like coming of age stories. And that's great. And that's important. And that has value. But the workshop last weekend was the first time that I had gotten to teach adults with bigger, fuller, richer life stories. And it's way better. you have more to say, you have more to reflect on, you have more life experience and perspective. You just gotta like recognize all that is in you and then like decide what has the most value to share. Like I'll happily teach the 18-year-olds again, but I really find so much more pleasure in hearing a diversity of stories. I had no idea it would be. Not right now. I took this semester off.
Okay, Robert?
If you would not like to address this issue, I fully understand, of course. But I've done in my life a lot of reading and listening about forgiveness.
Mm.
and social rehabilitation. Yeah. And the prison industry doesn't have much to do with rehabilitation. Most people get out more angry than they were when they went in.
Right.
But there is a reform in progress. How do you feel about the person who killed your grandfather? You go to the parole board. You were talking about going to the parole board.
Yeah. There's the logical and rational side of me that knows those things about our justice system and understands it. And I think where I struggle is that when you lose someone to violence, it's hard to remember them without that piece, right? So when I think of my grandpa, it's not that I just get to, like, I've lost other people in gentler ways. And when I think of my grandpa, I have a hard time not thinking about looking at a casket and seeing bruises on his hands from where he tried to fight back against two men with tire irons. And it's the emotional side of that loss and how he suffered and what I know to be true about the justice system and what would be right and true for that man who's had 25 years in prison to reflect on what he's done. I don't know which one wins, you know?
Well, do you think punishment is the answer?
I don't know what kind of experience he's had and if it has been punishment. I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah. I wish I knew.
And you can live the question. And I wanted to just thank you personally. That was a most amazing story. And your fear about being embarrassed by your little dance, not at all. Because your talk was a lesson in vulnerability.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately.
Yes, it was a very good example of how vulnerability can open up the heart. I felt such a good heart space after listening to you today. I just want to thank you for that.
Thanks. That was the goal, not to make people sad, but like, can I like be honest and say this stuff without crying, but be true to like what happened and just own the emotion of it. I think it also is another turning 40 thing. Like, my necklace that I wear all the time says, as is. It's like, you get what you get. I'm going to do it and try my best. And, I don't know, I'll probably screw up a little bit.
One reason we're all here is that this is such a safe place. Because a lot of people here have spoken. And like I said, I've been a worship associate for 10 years, and I mess up. Sometimes, and it doesn't bother me a lot because everybody here just laughs. And if you forget something or if you leave something out or do something wrong, they just tell you. And nobody's going, oh my God, rolling their eyes at you, you know, if you're not perfect, thank
us
all.
Well, no one ever spoke in my church other than the pastor, ever. Like, that's not something that happened. There wasn't sharing. There weren't questions. That's not what we did. There was routine, and there was the pastor said this stuff. We repeated the creeds. We sang a hymn, and we went home. And that was it, you know?
I want to say thank you also, and it was very moving. And I think I want to have see if I can get my both of my daughters to hear what you said. I think it's very important and insightful and may help them in their lives.
Thanks.
Yeah, Frank Lockwood was telling me that a friend of his had visited just once before and you know, didn't know if he or she, I don't know which, would come back or not, and came back today. And he said, what a perfect talk for someone who might be looking for a church home to hear, because as Bobby told us, it wasn't like some brilliant epiphany. One day she's a Lutheran, one day she's an atheist, and the next day she's a Unitarian. It was a process, and that's comforting to people.
And the reason we passed this mic around is because this is being recorded, as was your talk, so people can access that through our archives, which I think is really valuable. And I was part of this discussion with Judy where Frank thought that maybe new people considering membership should hear Bobby's talk beforehand. And so maybe the membership team, with Bobby's permission,
sure,
would consider doing something like that. I don't know.
Do we need to edit out the part where I say sex in church?
No, we don't.
Jared said it was okay.
Well, I join the chorus of tremendous thanks for your writerly presentation, but also I thought, oh God, she'd be a great actress. Really, really.
It's not too late to get famous and make millions.
Yeah. That's the way it happens. All the arts are like that. But, but I wanted to also thank you for a fun kind of look into the child eye view of what in the heck are they talking about, and the skewed ideas you get. That would be fun. That would be a little essay all in itself.
Yeah. This is the body of Christ shed for you, so we're eating Jesus.
Isn't that great? Yeah, and I always wondered why. I was raised Methodist, and why at Christmas time all these grown men were running around in their bathrobes, and that was supposed to be a holy thing, and all those skewed perceptions you get because nobody fills in the blanks. You just kind of have to figure it out.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be really, you're supposed to be quiet and nice and wear your patent leather shoes.
Yeah.
Because this is all holy stuff. And what? Didn't have anything to do with hanging from the apple tree, which I thought was holy stuff.
No, that's exactly how I felt. And no one in my family was like, let's sit and talk about, like, why we say this stuff and why we do this stuff. Like, what does it mean to you and what do you think? Like, we still don't do that. They don't know I'm doing this today. Oh, no. Oh, no.
And we have run out of time, and it was a wonderful talk, and we appreciate it so much.
Thanks, Judy. Thank you all. I appreciate it. Mm.